From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, let's do the twist. Chubby Checker made it to the top of the charts with a twist, but Hank Ballard wrote the song and recorded it first. We'll talk with Hank Ballard and with Ron Mann, the director of a new documentary on the twist and how it changed youth culture. Also today, from Hollywood to Hanoi, we meet Tiana. Her father is South Vietnam's former press liaison. Tiana was Bruce Lee's only female student. Her new documentary is about her return to Vietnam. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the record that changed his life. It may surprise you. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton met with the exiled president of Haiti at the White House today. NPR's Mara Liasson has the story.
The president praised Jean-Bertrand Aristide for signing an agreement that would return Haiti to democracy and Aristide to office. As part of that agreement, the United States will participate in an international military force that will help Haiti make the transition to democracy by training the Haitian military and helping to create an independent civilian police force. As soon as Aristide names a prime minister, the United Nations trade embargo of Haiti will be lifted. Since the coup 2 years ago that toppled Aristide, UN sanctions have barred oil and arms exports to Haiti, and the sanctions have frozen the assets of the military leaders who led the coup. The agreement signed by Aristide calls on him to grant amnesty to the men who ousted him, but it does not spell out which of the military leaders will be granted amnesty. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Emergency officials say that the area of greatest flood danger on the Mississippi River is now a 100-mile stretch from St. Louis south to the point where the Ohio joins the Mississippi. The latest place to be overwhelmed was Kaskaskia Island, where levees failed and forced the evacuation of about 100 people. A spokesman for the Army Corps of Engineers said officials are concerned that levees are being stressed by holding back floodwaters for an extended period of time. He said the levees are weakened as they become saturated with water. 6 weeks of flooding in the Mississippi Valley have killed at least 31 people and displaced 31,000 others. Damage is estimated at more than $10 billion. After a 12-day wait, parts of Des Moines, Iowa have running water again. For member station WOI, Mark Moran reports.
That's the sound people in Des Moines have been longing to hear for a week and a half. Running water at the tap, in the toilets, and in the shower. People no longer have to go to the suburbs to bathe or wash with cold rainwater. For this Des Moines man, the water's return is the first step on the road back to his normal morning routine, which disappeared 12 days ago.
And we would cart over the algae-encrusted pond water, and we would pour it into the back of our toilets and then flush it.
While running water is slowly making its way back into the homes here, it is not safe to drink. That's because it contains high levels of iron from pipes that have been empty and chlorine added to clean it. Safe drinking water is at least several weeks away. City officials are cautioning people to treat even the contaminated water preciously. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 3,525. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 4.56 points at 695.52. This is NPR News from Washington. The Conservative government of British Prime Minister John Major faces a vote of confidence tomorrow in Parliament. Major was forced to call the vote after he lost in a showdown on the Treaty on European Unity. Major had pledged to bring the treaty to a ratification vote in the near future. Britain is now the only EC country that hasn't ratified the treaty. A medical expert testifying in the trial of three Detroit police officers charged in the death of a black man said today the victim would not have died if he had not been under the influence of cocaine. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
According to prosecutors, Malice Green, a black man, was beaten to death with police flashlights by two white officers last November. Those two are on trial for murder. A third white officer is charged with assault. But a defense expert today challenged whether flashlight blows to the head alone caused Green's death. Dr. L.J. Dragovich, a specialist in brain pathology, said alcohol and cocaine in Malice Green's system accelerated his brain seizures. The doctor was questioned by defense attorney John Goldpaw.
So you're essentially saying that the death in this particular case resulted from a combination of the effects of cocaine and of this bruising on the brain?
That is correct, sir.
Prosecutors are expected to call their own expert witnesses to counter Dragovich's testimony. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
Nicaraguan government troops fought with rebels today for control of a northern town in the worst violence since the country's civil war. Hospital officials in the town say they treated as many as 100 wounded civilians, and military officers said that more than 20 people were killed. The rebels are former fighters on both sides of the civil war who want the government of President Violeta Chamorro to deliver on promises of land and assistance. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's twist. Teenagers loved the new dance craze, but lots of adults were alarmed by all the shaking hips and swiveling pelvises. And why were all those young people dancing apart? In a few minutes, we'll hear from the director of a new documentary about the twist and how it changed teen culture. The record behind the dance craze was Chubby Checker's 1960 number one hit, which we just heard. But the song was written by R&B singer Hank Ballard, who also had the first recording of it. The movie The Twist is dedicated to him. Here's his original 1959 recording. We called Hank Ballard at his home in Los Angeles and asked him to remember the first time he heard Chubby Checker's cover of his song.
Yeah, I was in Miami taking a swim, you know, and I heard this twist blasting across white radio, pop station down in Miami, the biggest pop station down there. I feel good because King Records wasn't getting in a white airplay, you know, in the pop airplay. I said, last I'm getting some pop airplay, you know. Maybe I become a superstar, you know. But when the man said, Chevy Checker, after the first chorus, I knew it wasn't me, you know. But when the first eight bars, I thought it was me.
So the first time you heard Chubby Checker's recording of The Twist, for the first chorus, you thought it was you. Then you realized it wasn't you. When you listen to those records now, what do you think of the comparison between your version and the cover?
I know my version is superior to Chubby Checker's. If you put the two on, you can see the difference. My version has more guts in it, more drive, and my vocal is a little superior over Chubby Checker. When I hear some of these reporters, when I see, sometimes they write that Chubby Checker had a slicker version. What was slick about his version? I don't know. The slickness came when American Bandstand was playing it, Dick Clark. That's what made The Twist. You could have recorded The Twist and it would have been a hit if Dick Clark was playing it.
You think so?
Yeah, but man, during that time, you could record a grunt. If Dick Clark played it, it was a hit overnight.
No, how come Dick Clark played Chubby Checker's version of The Twist and not yours?
Chubby Checker was in Dick Clark's stable. You know, he had a stable of artists. That was Frankie Avalon, Bobby Rydell, Didi Shock, Fabian. All these acts was in his stable.
Yeah, and Chubby Checker was one of the guys from Philadelphia where Bandstand came out.
Yeah, but see, he was also... Okay, I'll give you a good hint. Dick Clark's wife is the one that named him Chubby Checker. Doesn't that tell you something?
Right, so he was in on the record.
It was a lot of politics going on during that time with this particular record, between Dick Clark and my record company.
Uh-huh.
Dick Clark made Finger Poppin' Time a hit. You know, my A&R man told me that Dick Clark made a deal with King Records, that if they didn't release my version of The Twist, he would make Finger Poppin' Time a hit for me, which he did.
So do you think most people realize now that you wrote The Twist and recorded
it
first?
No, they associate The Twist with Chubby Checker.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, Chubby Checker, next to Jesus Christ, Chubby Checker is second to Jesus Christ around the world. There's nowhere in this world you can go in the most remote areas that somebody don't know about Chubby Checker. But that, you know what, that doesn't mean anything to me because I'm not into the stars and all the commercial admiration, you know?
Well, when you go to one of these remote areas, do you ever say, well, I'm the guy who did it first?
Nope. Unless if we are appearing now, they always tell them on stage, you know, that this is the original version that I recorded in 1958. This is the way we did it in 1958. But the best thing ever happened to me was Chubby Checker doing The Twist, because King Records just didn't like it. It was just lying down on the shelf gathering dust, you know?
Right. So have you spent much time with Chubby Checker?
Oh, yeah. You know what? See, Chubby has a terrible ego. See, but I've been nice to Chubby down through the years, been nice to him and his wife. It's just that I can't handle his ego sometimes, you know? And I know that Chubby don't care that much about me, you know, but it doesn't make me a difference how he feel about me, you know? She goes, I'm a thorn in his side. I'm like a nuisance, you know? He cannot go down in history without dragging me with him. And he hates that because he wants to be the owner of The Twist, you know?
I see what you're saying.
Can
we go back to the mid-50s and talk about some of your hits from then?
Yeah.
There was your song, Work With Me, Annie.
You weren't even born then.
Oh, yes, I was.
That was in 1954.
I was born.
Huh?
Yeah.
That was 40 years ago or so.
Now, there were a lot of stations that banned that record from
They banned it.
made it
the biggest, it's the fifth biggest R&B record ever recorded.
What were the lyrics and why was it banned?
It was banned because I had suggestive lyrics. You know, like when I first wrote the song, I had a different title. I had Sock It To Me, Annie. But FCC, the Sock It To Me is a no-no. It's obscene. So I changed it to Roll With Me, Annie. They said Roll With Me is obscene. You can't use that lyric. So what I did, now during that time, that was a time in the ghetto in Detroit, they had a... They had this little slang going around. Say, man, did you get some work last night? You're talking about sex, you know. Did you get some work last night? So I know what I'll do. I'll call it Work With Me, Annie, you know? Then they won't know what I'm talking about. They can read between the lines. But what made it so obvious when the lyric, Annie, please don't cheat, give me all my meat. That's when the suggestive lyrics came in.
So was it hard for you to break the image of somebody who only wrote suggestive songs?
I think when I came up with Finger Poppin' Time and The Twist and Tore Up Over You been recorded by a lot of artists. Even in Look at Little Sister, Stevie Ray Vaughan had a big hit with Look at Little Sister. That was, matter of fact, that was one of his biggest hits, Look at Little Sister. I'm okay. You know, I can't even write like that now. I don't want to write suggestive lyrics, you know, because I have children and grandchildren, you know.
Well, did you think of The Twist and Finger Poppin' Time as suggestive?
No, but the FCC tried to say that The Twist was obscene, you know. But there's nothing obscene about The Twist and Finger Poppin' Time. I wrote Finger Poppin' Time. I was in a restaurant on Broadway there in New York. And it was a gentleman sitting next to me, and this young lady walked up and said, Mister, can you tell me what time it is? He popped his finger and said, Baby, it's Finger Poppin' Time. So I said, that sounds like a good song title, you know? I went to the hotel, wrote that one in about 15 minutes. All you need, if you get you a good hook line, you can go from there.
Listen, for any of our listeners who don't remember that song, would you just sing a couple of lines of it?
What, Thing of Poppin' Time?
Yeah.
Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, it's Thing of Poppin' Time. Thing of Poppin' Time. I feel so good. And that's a real good sign. Yes, I do feel good. I'm airborne, folks. No. You know what? I know with Soul Finger Popper Time, it has country overtones. The melody is country.
You think so?
Yeah, because my first music was country. I still like country music.
Huh.
Yeah, the whole melody, Finger Popper Time, and my rhythm is country. Now, on almost all my songs, my rhythm is my guitar doing country licks.
Well, that's interesting.
Well, yeah, when you listen, you'll hear. That's why nobody can play the twist the way my band does it, because most guitars don't play that country lick. You know, especially the black guitars. It's that country lick that makes my rhythm.
Hmm. So, why did the Midnighters break up?
They got involved with Malcolm X. They converted to. To the Muslim faith. See, and Malcolm X followed me around for about 2 years trying to convert me because they wanted, you had to give up 20% of your earnings, plus you had to stand on the corner and sell papers, and I didn't like the philosophy, the hate philosophy. You know, but I used to go to the temple just to hear him speak, you know? But I just didn't like the hate philosophy. I just couldn't, I have to be me. I refuse to be anybody but Hank Ballard. It's just not a part of my nature to hate. You know, the Midnighters got so involved they became fanatics, you know? Even Malcolm X told them they had gotten too fanatic. They didn't want to work any more white engagements, sign no more white autographs. And they used, well, let me tell you, 24 hours a day, all you could hear was how they hate white people, you know? So what happened, we was in Nassau doing a gig over there, and I called Elijah Muhammad a pimp. You know, I said, he's a pimp, you know. And why did I do that? They all jumped me, you know. If my agent hadn't been there, they probably would have killed me. Then I knew it was time to take him to court and try to secure the trade name, you know. But what happened, the union wanted me to go out as Hank Ballard and wanted them to take the Midnighters. I said, no, I want the whole trade name, you know, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. So... we had arbitration, and the arbitrator ruled in my favor. So I owned the whole trade name, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters.
You were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think, in 1990?
Yeah, but you know what?
What?
Prior to my induction, I used to see Chubby Checker there every year. Each year he was there, you know, we'd talk, we'd rap. But when I was inducted, I didn't see Chubby Checker. Now, if he had been inducted, I would have been there, wishing him well, you know? I think he was embarrassed or something, you know? I don't know why he didn't show up for my induction.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
You know, it's been nice talking to you, you know?
Hank Ballard spoke to us from his home in Los Angeles. He's still twisting. This is his down and dirty twist from his album Naked in the Rain, released last year.
Woo, y'all, y'all, y'all. The twist been clean too long. Let's make it dirty this time. Let's throw some dirt on it. Come on. Twist. Now down and dirty twist. Watch my stroke and go far broke and do it like first you slip and slide, you let your hands glide, throw your hips out of bounds, let the booty kiss the ground.
Hank Ballard from his latest album, Naked in the Rain. Coming up, a documentary on the twist. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, everybody. This is Joey D. I'm going to teach you how to dance the twist, so get ready to have a ball. Before we begin, let's make sure you're familiar with the instruction booklet. Be sure to keep the booklet handy so you can follow directions as we go along. Ready? Okay, let's do the twist.
Come on, baby. Let's do the twist.
There's a new documentary called The Twist that will do much more than teach you how to do it. It's the story of how The Twist changed youth culture. Director Ron Mann spent years going through archival footage of dance shows, variety shows, news shows, movies, commercials, everything he could find relating to The Twist. He also interviewed Hank Ballard, Chubby Checker, Dee Dee Clark of Mashed Potato fame, dancers from American Bandstand, and many others. Mann is the director of previous films about comics, performance poetry, and jazz. I asked him why he wanted to make a film about The Twist.
Well, I'm interested in cultural history, and I wanted to contribute to the historical record. And rock and roll, we know the history of rock and roll, but we don't know the history of rock and roll dance. I wanted to do the real story of Dirty Dancing.
What do you think is the importance of The Twist is in the development of teen culture?
In 1957 in Philadelphia, you had the birth of American Bandstand, and you also had, nationally, and you also had simultaneously the growth of the teen idol era. At that time, people thought that rock and roll was the devil's music. And American Bandstand had a job really to clean up rock and roll and make it safe. And American Bandstand was the MTV of its time. It was like after school, the streets would be clear because...
You had to turn it on.
Yeah, you would be dancing with your doorknob at home. And, you know, if you were like a hip kid in 57 and through those years, you'd be watching American Bandstand. You also had, though, a kind of reactionary, growth in the music, which was the teen idol era. And it became so... safe, that it and squeaky clean, that it really, I think, hurt the development of rock and roll. The point of the film is that rock and roll is rhythm and blues. And if it wasn't for artists like Hank Ballard, who in 1954, for example, performed a song with the Midnighters called "Work with Me, Annie," it was banned on the radio, and it was taken off the jukeboxes in Boston, which really meant, as Hank said in an interview, that white kids were buying it. Their parents would go out shopping and they would take their sides from underneath the bed and play it. And it was responsible for popularizing rock and roll. And that rock and roll just became, you know, so it became whitened, quite frankly. And I really wanted to explode myths in this film about teen culture, for example, and kid culture, and that is that everything doesn't come from Elvis Presley, and all the dances don't come from American Bandstand. The dances originally are African-American dances. I think that the twist really became popular in 1961 when Joey D did the twist, because it's when the media picked up on the jet setters or adults doing the twist. Then it became acceptable. In a way, the film is about the domestication of the twist and how it became accessible, and how the music industry works, how it pushes a product, how it's really about capitalism, quite frankly. Teen culture was ignored, really, except to sell a product to the growing baby boomers.
What are your very favorite twist records?
You know, when I finished this film, I never wanted to hear another Twist song as long as I lived.
Well, estimate for us how many you think you heard during the course of your
research. I tracked over 300 Twist songs.
Uh-huh.
These are Twist spinoff songs.
Mm-hmm.
Twist Sonora, Gary Us Bonds, Twist of the Night Away, Sam Cooke, Twist McMeer.
McMeer.
It's German. You know, my favorite song is Duane Eddy doing Twisting Off a Cliff. It goes down, down, and down, down, and down, down, and down, down, and ah! That's the whole song. My favorite Twist cover is Ray Charles doing the Twist. It's called Twisting with Ray Charles. Now, there's not one Twist song on the entire album, but they sold it. Became a huge hit because it just said Twist on the cover. You could sell anything with the word Twist attached to it.
So you heard hundreds of Twist recordings. Did you get archival footage of people doing the Twist around the world?
There was so much Twist footage around the world, I couldn't fit it in. We have twisting elephants. We have twisting in outer space. We have a version of the Twist in the Soviet Union, which was called the Terracon. They thought the Twist was Western decadence, so they came up with their own Twist version, which was called the Terracon. Twisting in Vietnam, Saigon. I was twisted out. The Twist footage was quite, of that period of 61, when the Twist craze happened, was just really unbelievable. Now, there is one piece that I've never found. It's kind of my holy grail, which was Chubby Checker doing the Twist on WOR. Now, the TV station in New York City in 1916. And I tracked down the director, you know, who directed this spot. This is hour on the hour instructions on how to do the Twist. And if you can imagine, it was really, really big. But I could never find it. And there's a lot of footage that I couldn't find, simply because it didn't exist. But the footage that I did find was quite wacky.
What are your favorite Twist instructional records?
The Twist instructional record that we use in the film was from Joey D. And, you know, King Curtis put out a Arthur Murray Twist song, and that actually is my favorite. Dancing was so big back then. I mean, it was the thing to do. Like, people go to movies now, or, you know, it must have been incredible.
Ron Mann's documentary, The Twist, has opened in Philadelphia, former home of American Bandstand. It opens in New York and Los Angeles August 13th, then in other cities. Well, we don't have a copy of one of Mann's favorite recordings, Twistin' with Ray Charles, but what luck, we do have a copy of the Chubby Checker record, The Ray Charleston, from Checker's album, Let's Twist Again. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Let's do the Ray Charleston.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a new documentary about a Vietnamese American returning to Vietnam that's been called funny, messy, and brave, just like its director, Tiana. We'll talk to Tiana, a self-described American black sheep and karate princess who studied with Bruce Lee and has been an actress in B-exploitation films. She returned to Vietnam against the will of her father, who used to be the press liaison for the South Vietnamese government. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the record that changed his life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Republicans were not successful today in their attempt to make documents in the House Post Office investigation public. The House defeated the effort in a party-line vote, but only after both sides traded accusations. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
It was a contentious day in the House of Representatives. Republicans blocked passage of flood relief on procedural grounds and then launched an all-out attack on Democrats for what members said was a cover-up that included Speaker Tom Foley. Foley appeared twice on the House floor to argue against disclosure of documents in the ongoing investigation of embezzlement in the House Post Office.
So that if there has been wrongdoing, it may be prosecuted and punished if convicted. That is what we ought to be focusing on. That is what we ought to support. And that is why we should respectfully reject the resolution of the gentleman, the minority leader.
The House voted to refuse release of the documents unless a federal prosecutor agrees to it. Republicans say Democrats are protecting House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski, who may have received embezzled money. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
In London, British Prime Minister John Major has been forced to call a confidence vote tomorrow in the House of Commons in order to gain approval for ratification of a treaty on European unity. Major lost this evening on a government motion in support of the treaty. He lost by a vote of 324 to 316, with some Conservative members joining the opposition. The treaty has now been ratified by every member of the European community except for Britain. The Senate today was sidetracked from consideration of the president's proposed national service program by a dispute over the Confederate flag. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The debate began when Republican Jesse Helms of North Carolina introduced an unrelated amendment to the National Service Bill that would extend a patent protecting the insignia of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. That insignia contains the first flag of the Confederacy. Senators at first agreed to Helms' amendment, but later backtracked when Illinois Democrat Carol Mosley Braun, the Senate's only African-American member, threatened to filibuster over what she said was the Senate's approval of a symbol of racism.
If I have to stand here till this room freezes over, I'm not going to see this amendment put on this legislation, which has to do with national service.
Senators, who appeared not to have realized the impact of their initial vote, quickly rushed to support Mosley Braun, and Helms' amendment was killed on a 75-25 vote. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 30 points to close at 3,525.22 on volume of 248 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 12-7 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. House Republicans have proposed an education plan that concentrates on school choice. Supporters of the plan say it calls for the use of tax-funded vouchers that parents could use to pay for private schooling. A spokesman for Education Secretary Riley called the plan the same gridlock that's been underway for the last 12 years. President Clinton's education package is slated for consideration in the House next week. It calls for voluntary national school standards for schools and a national council to certify that schools are meeting standards. State Department officials told a congressional subcommittee today that technical flaws within the visa system, not CIA involvement, allowed fundamentalist Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman into the U.S. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Sheikh Abdelrahman received entry visas to make seven trips to the United States between 1986 and 1990, even though he was supposed to be ineligible, State Department officials said today. State Department Inspector General Sherman Funk told a House Foreign Affairs subcommittee that U.S. Embassy officials in Egypt and Sudan had turned down visa applications for Abdulrahman just once because of his alleged links to terrorism. Funk claimed that Abdulrahman was able to exploit general sloppiness in enforcement of immigration laws and regulations to obtain U.S. visas and permanent resident status. However, the Inspector General declined to comment on published reports that the CIA may have assisted Abdulrahman in coming to the United States. Followers of the Sheikh have been charged in February's bombing of the World Trade Center in New York. He is currently in federal custody awaiting deportation. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Nicaragua, there's been more heavy fighting involving government forces and former rebel troops and discharged soldiers. The 2 days of fighting are called among the worst since the end of the nation's civil war. Rebels charge that the government has not carried through on promises of land and financial aid. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When my guest Tiana was a girl growing up in Saigon, she was given a Chatty Cathy doll by JFK. Tiana's father was the press liaison for the South Vietnamese government. He brought his family to the States in 1966 when Tiana was three. He was convinced that his government could not win the war. After moving back and forth for several years, the family settled here when Tiana was seven. When she was 16, she ran away from home and went to Hollywood, where she did everything from a karate video to an exploitation film and a few small roles in mainstream films. In 1988, against the wishes of her family, she returned to South Vietnam. Over the next 3 years, she made several trips back to make her documentary From Hollywood to Hanoi, which has just opened in New York. The film combines her personal story with the story of life in Vietnam today. I asked Tiana if she was aware of the anti-war movement when she was growing up in the States.
I was very, very aware of the anti-war movement because in the late 60s, going to school in Arlington, Virginia as a child, there was desegregation, there were a lot of political issues, and people were always saying, are you a Gook, are you a VC, what are you? I remember not wanting to be Vietnamese at all. It was a painful thing. We were watching the 6 o'clock news every night. So in the 70s, I remember wondering, why is this still going on, all the pain, all the suffering? When will I be able to go back to visit my country? And it was the Vietnam vets, Vets Against the War, Senator John Kerry, who headed Vets Against the War. I listened to them on the news. I went to Washington, D.C. when I was 14, and I joined this march for peace, which when my father found out, he was very, very upset, because under his rule, we went for marches for the war. We were in these moral rearmament shows and marches. Freedom isn't free. You got to fight for your liberty. So I was very torn even then, from the time I can remember, of being in marches against the war and in marches for peace. I think if you're for peace, you are against the war. But I was in marches for the war. And that was what caused a big breach between me and my father.
When you left Vietnam, your father told you that this was the last time you'd see your country. But as you grew older, you really wanted to get back. Why did you want to go back so badly?
It was the dreams, Terry. I have these reoccurring dreams. Five Vietnamese women come to me in my dreams, and someone pointed out to me that they're all incarcerated. There's a woman in a go-go cage who talks to me, and she tells me about her two Amerasian children and that she made $2,000 being a sexy dancer. Now, she didn't say a go-go dancer in my dreams. In Vietnam, 2 years ago, just talking to someone on the street who is selling cigarettes one at a time because Vietnam is very poor, she said, I said, what did you used to do? And she said, in English, I was a sexy dancer. I said, you speak English? She said, yes, I have two Amerasian children I'd love for you to meet. And she started talking like the woman in my dreams. Like, I've been having these dreams since I was 6 years old. So I began to one by one meet the women in my dreams. And it was just absolutely amazing. But to answer your question, that's what drew me back, were my dreams of these voices from the other side, the people who either we left behind or chose not to come or couldn't get out.
What did your father think of you trying to return?
My father was very afraid for me. He thought I would be captured and thrown into the Hanoi Hilton. There are Vietnamese people today who think that it's wrong for me to have Hanoi in my title, and that if they go back, they might be captured. And I can only say, please come see the movie. From Hollywood to Hanoi is beyond just my personal story. It is also a chance for all of us immigrants, we all came from somewhere, to see that we could go back. You know, there is a chance. You can't turn your back on your heritage. That I found out.
When you decided to return to Vietnam, did you know you wanted to make a movie about that trip?
Absolutely not. I never, never dreamed in my life I'd be sitting here today talking to you and opening the film in New York City. I went back with Vietnam vets, including Oliver Stone, to look around, to see, for me, to smell the smells and to remember the poetry. I didn't even think I had relatives to visit. I thought we had all made it to America. We assumed anyone who didn't make it had died by the hands of the communists. In fact, I found my uncle, who was Minister of Defense for the South Vietnamese government, sitting in his home. The total lack of information and the isolation between America and Vietnam was what caused me to rush back home to Hollywood, where I was living. I sold everything I had, and I was back within 6 weeks.
My guest is Tiana, and she's just made a movie called From Hollywood to Hanoi, and it's about her return to Vietnam, where she grew up. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tiana, director of the new film From Hollywood to Hanoi. Did a lot of memories come back to you when you got to Vietnam?
Yes, yes. I stood outside the Carafel Hotel, and I remember when I was waiting for my dad when I was 6 years old to come out of a press conference, and there was a big explosion, and I thought it was in the hotel in front of me. It was in the hotel behind me, which was the Continental, which now is like a $200 on up a night hotel, very upmarket now in Saigon. No one calls it Ho Chi Minh City. It is Saigon. Even the Vietnamese government calls it Saigon. And there I was, and, you know, I thought my father was killed, and he came out from behind me, and he said, let's go home. And there were people, you know, just bloodied, dying everywhere, and these are the things that can never escape you.
You say that at the edge of Hanoi, your childhood fears came back. What were those fears?
Well, first of all, I had never been to Hanoi. That was where those people spoke funny, had black teeth. They would eat us for breakfast. Certainly, if we were captured by Ho Chi Minh or his henchmen, they would tear us to pieces and cook us, you know. And of course, as an adult, I know that, you know, that can't be true. But still, as you're reaching, forbidden territory, these things come back to you, and you try to shake it off, but you can't. And I thought that they would hate me. We bombed them for decades. So I was very, very afraid. And then one of the first things I saw was the funeral of a Catholic cardinal in Hanoi, and millions of people in the street mourning for him. And I thought, well, this is a different kind of communism. This is Hanoi, but there are 3 million Catholics. And I began to slowly unpeel the onion. And, you know, every layer makes you cry because there is so much to rediscover.
Do you think that your trips to Vietnam have inspired your father to consider returning himself for a visit?
I think that my father thinks all the time of going back one day. But as he explained to me and to a lot of audience members who've seen From Hollywood to Hanoi, because he has come and spoken with me at universities, and he said that I am trapped by my political beliefs. I cannot go back. I am afraid that they will use my trip back for political gains, they being the Vietnamese government, or, of course, his community in San Jose will ostracize him if he goes back to Vietnam. They're very anti-communist. So he is trapped in that respect. I, on the other hand, have never cared much what people think about what I do, because I find that when you try to please everybody, as I did as an actress, you don't get it anyway. And so I think if you go from the heart and you do what you believe in, people will come and support you, and that's what's happened with this film. So I and my father, it's really funny when the two of us speak because we're at both ends of the pole, I say that I am swayed by my artistic and humanitarian concerns, and he admits that he's swayed by his political concerns. And that is a generational gap that I think is very common in most families, because when he says political, when my father says he's trapped by political beliefs, he really means he's trapped by his stubbornness, that he has announced that he will never go back unless the communist government moves over or surrenders or whatever. And then how could he ever go back? I have told him many times that this will not happen, that the Vietnamese are so busy now. Giai tiền means running for money. They're so busy trying to make a buck and make ends meet and buy antibiotics and books for their children. They're not ready for a revolution. And because there is free trade now, and there are Vietnamese dollar millionaires in Hanoi and Saigon right now as we speak, there is very little chance of that. But there is every chance that we can influence them through our coming over. And I think, you know, once you've seen Paris, you don't want to go back to the farm, that sort of thing. I don't think the Vietnamese government can shut down the country now that they have opened up.
You learned martial arts from Bruce Lee when you were a teenager. Do you still practice?
I haven't been, because I'm now distributing the film myself and I'm wearing 18 hats. But whenever I'm waiting for a subway, I do a couple of kicks and everybody sort of moves away. But I would very much love to get back into the martial arts. It's a great form of discipline. And I miss Bruce Lee very much.
Have you ever had to use the martial arts for self-protection?
I did once, and I very, very regretted it. It's a very, very unpleasant thing when you have to be in combat to fight against somebody. In this case, it was a girl who was really hassling me.
What was she doing?
Well, this was a very, very horrible racist incident. You were taught, you know, to rise above this. But, you know, this was a very bad racist incident in which we were really taunted. And then she just started, you know, just kind of smacking me across the face. And I exercised Jeet Kune Do, the way of the intercepting fist. I smashed her face, and it was just really bad. I had to deal with the police, and of course I got off because she started it. But it's bad even if you don't start it. But hey, you know, when you have to defend yourself, you have to defend yourself. And you learn in the form of martial arts to walk away from trouble.
You said that you were Bruce Lee's only female student. Was that because he didn't want to teach girls, or is that because you were the only female who was interested?
Bruce Lee was very, very chauvinistic. He felt that you should be with your father, your uncle, your brother when you're out late at night, so why would you need to defend yourself? And then he also believed that you know, a girl really can't beat up on a big guy, and he didn't want to mislead any students. I just convinced him that I would work hard, twice as hard, that I could be faster, stronger than most boys. And he finally said, yeah. He said, you were a boy in your other life. He said, I'll teach you. But I think he was just plain chauvinistic, and I say that with great fondness. He was a great man, a great teacher. He was very much into Zen and Sufi, and I still have his writings, and they mean a lot to me. Bruce Lee is not the Bruce Lee in the movies, you know, now that we've got the Hollywood version of it. He was not a god. He made mistakes. He was a human being. And I think that we should remember him as a great father and a great martial artist, and he was a great teacher.
Tiana's new film is called From Hollywood to Hanoi. She's also the founder of the Indochina Film Arts Foundation, which plans to establish a cultural exchange program in the Mekong Delta. This is Fresh Air. Des Moines has running water again. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on the flood on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report from Des Moines, Iowa, where tap water is again flowing. Robert Siegel talks with someone in St. Genevieve, Missouri. They're still worrying about the levees possibly giving away there. Don Gagne reports on the additional problems of pollution the high water from the Mississippi is presenting. Nina Totenberg reports tonight on the third day of Senate committee hearings for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to join the Supreme Court. A report from Sarajevo, a tough day of shelling there, casting doubt on the possibility of Bosnian peace talks in Geneva. And a few thoughts on the centennial of America the Beautiful.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock historian Ed Ward was a rock and roll veteran early on. By the time many of us were just starting to pay attention to the stuff, Ed was already bored. Then Ed says he chanced upon a scratchy, poorly recorded collection that changed his life.
Music lover has one, a record that seems to be the starting point, the musical document that made them realize that this was something to look into. You keep going back to it over the years and looking at it from a different perspective, finding something new each time. For some people, it's a Beatles record, or a Miles Davis record, or who knows, maybe even an Aerosmith record. For me, it was something really strange.
Gonna build me log cabin on a mountain so high so I can see Willie as he goes on by.
In junior high school, I was a rock and roll veteran. I'd been listening to it since 1957, and now, in 1961, I was tired of how dull it had become. I fell in with a crowd that included a pair of twin brothers from a classic New York left-wing Jewish background, and one day, one of them invited me to go see Pete Seeger at Carnegie Hall. There were others on the bill, including Clarence Ashley, a Carolinian, who had recorded The Cuckoo, a banjo tune, in the 20s, and Ashley had brought along a young man, Arthel Watson, to play guitar. Watson, whose friends called him Doc, was phenomenal, and the ancient-sounding music Ashley and his friends played, as well as the beatnik-looking crowd at the show, appealed to me in a powerful way. Folk music, I thought, that's what I'll get into. So, on my next trip to the public library, I went looking for some records that'd teach me about folk music. I found what I was looking for.
Went up on the hill about 12 o'clock, reached right back and got me a pole. Went to the hard barn, got me a hook.
It was called, simply, Anthology of American Folk Music on Folkways Records, and it was a three-volume, two records per volume, collection of 78s recorded between 1927 and 1932, taken from the collection of a very eccentric Australian named Harry Smith. Clarence Ashley was there, which is why I picked it up, but so were a lot of other people, like ragtime Henry Thomas playing guitar and panpipes, one of the last purveyors of the oldest African-American song style ever to be recorded. There were Cajuns, preachers, blues singers, solo fiddlers, singing cowboys, and fat black ladies with tambourines. It was bewildering, messy, alien, and familiar at once, some of it horribly out of tune, and some of it with more magic than any music ought to have.
Nothing like it used to be. And I'm telling you all the truth. Oh, take it for me. I haven't seen better days, but I'm putting up with these. I haven't seen better days, but I'm putting up with these. I could have a much better time with these girls. Now it's so hard to please.
Richard Rabbit Brown's menacing James Alley Blues scared me to death, and still does. And in the liner notes to one of his albums, you can read that it had the same effect on Bob Dylan. Smith divided the anthology into three volumes, ballads, social music, and songs. Ballads told stories, social music was dancing and religious music, and songs were just singing about stuff like lost love or going fishing. For a young teenager like me, ballads were where the deepest mysteries were hiding. Clarence Ashley singing about the house carpenter who was really a fairy and took his wife and child to hell. G.B. Grayson telling of the murder of Omi Wise. And Kelly Harrell singing in the first person of Charles Guiteau, assassin of James Garfield. But the songs and dances were pretty good. And the religious music was filled with surprises like sacred harp singing. All this was held together by the booklet in each box that summarized the songs in telegraphic style. Albert dies preferring Alice Fry, but judge finds Frankie charming at latter's trial, was how he summed up Mississippi John Hurt's Frankie. Smith's Folkways anthology changed the way I heard American music forever. It provided me with hundreds of clues for further astonishing listening, gave me hootenanny material, and confirmed my intuition that eccentricity is deeply ingrained in the American character. Recently, I was talking to somebody from Rounder Records, who with the Smithsonian Institution are administering the Folkways catalog these days, and he said that the anthology will probably not be transferred to CD because ownership of the rights to these tracks is hazy. I can't think of a better reason to hold on to a turntable in that case, because I know I'm not the only person whose life was changed by this collection.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our weekly program of favorites from the archives takes a musical turn. We'll feature interviews with Charlie Rich and Rye Cooter. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for country music and blues on the next Fresh Air.